Okay, you know, in order for you guys to be able to eat your lunch properly, I just brought a bunch of reprints, okay, that I'm trying to get rid of, so you don't have to take any notes. So why don't you just distribute them? They are brief reprints, so, you know, it's not that many trees that died for this. Yeah, they're all the same.
This is all going to be posted on the web anyway.
The what?
When you're transparency.
Sure, if you want, to post them on the web.
You can hear it any time.
Sure, you can post it on the web if you want. I don't care.
And we can hear it over and over.
Sure. I'll be happy to if you hear it over and over. Okay, let's see. Yes, this is my first test here. It's okay, don't turn off the lights.
Well, just a fun one. Can you?
Okay. Because I don't want you guys to, I mean, you eat lunch and then you fall asleep and then, you know, that's kind of thing. Okay?
It's true.
So, is this a web focus for you? Okay, so. No, because what happens is I have a lot of different collaborators from all parts of the world, and every one of them has different kind of funding things. So these are mostly Spanish thing, except for this New York thing. Okay. Bob Dines actually also forces me to show that actually the University of California at UCSD has light as our logo, so I have to show that transparent service. So this is going to be about photoexcitation in superconductors. Now this is a long story because actually I did my thesis about this. As Doug might remember, this was very hot stuff about God knows some N years ago. And see, this is the reason that I had so many acronyms, because I had so many collaborators from different countries and things, okay? So there were people from Argentina, Belgium, Colombia, France, all over the place. It looks like high energy physics. But every paper, you know, there is a lot of papers that I'm going to summarize here. So what I will tell you is not a historical sort of a thing, like, you know, what did I do in camp, but I'm going to tell you sort of a logical evolution of this whole business. Okay, so... Now, I thought since I'm coming to the Theoretical Physics Institute, and since you guys subject us to all kind of things, like all kind of Green's functions and things like that, then I'll show you all my Green's functions, which are all these technical developments, but then I decided maybe I'll spare you that. But what I want to do is, what I will just mention very briefly, that the work that I will describe to you is based on a lot of technical developments that have to be done before doing this kind of a work. And that turns out to be crucial. And this somehow relates to the discussion that we're having today in the morning, because I'm extraordinarily concerned about things like multiple phases and broad transitions and interpretations of things that rely on sort of experimental things that are not well established. So basically, there was a bunch of things that we have done, and I think I have somewhere a list of, that I will tell you about a little bit about technical developments, then I'll tell you about photoexcitations, and in photoexcitation I will tell you about a lot of properties that we have measured, resistivity, Hall effect, structure, something on phase spreads, and the frequency dependence. And then at the end of it all, I will actually turn things around, and I will put up some models, and then I will leave you for some open questions. And the future is probably, I don't know where is the future going to go with this whole thing. Okay, so the idea of this whole thing is the following. Is you can take a material, there's more generality to what I'm talking than just superconductors. You can take many different kind of materials, you can irradiate them with light, and you can see that if you irradiate them with light, you can produce carriers into these materials, and if you produce carriers into these materials, the properties are changed. So these are the so-called induced phenomena. And you see there is a whole class of different materials. There's DX centers in gallium arsenide, dilute magnetic semiconductors, manganese telluride, and in fact, recently we have found similar phenomena in the... I'm sorry if I'm blocking you here. Recently we have found similar phenomena in the manganites also. Actually, this was originally started by, from all the places in the world, an ex-classmate of mine in graduate school, Ken Miyano, who's now in Tokyo, is the head of the Applied Physics Department in Tokyo, who works, we kind of converged to the same thing, strangely enough. And there was some work that actually motivated our work in 1990. There was a Russian paper by a man by the name of Kudinov, who now actually I'm told he's selling real estate in the Soviet Union or whatever, the Russia, that he found that if he takes yttrium barium copper oxide and irradiates it with light, the resistance of this material decreases. Okay, that's what motivated us to look into it. But the question that I wanted to ask is not that. What I wanted to ask is the question, can you stimulate some collective phenomena instead of this damn thing? So can these electrons that you or holes that you're producing with light, can they actually produce some collective phenomena? Can they condense into a collective state? And that's none of the other things do. Okay? And that's in fact what we are investigating now with the manganese, to see if can they produce a magnetic collective state. Okay? So this was the first paper in. So that's sort of the question that we're trying to. Okay, so here it is, the technical, this is the Green's functions that I was going to tell you about, but then I decided to spare you. The technical developments that you have to do in order to be able to do this kind of experiments. First of all, you have to be able to make very flat films over something of the order of 500 angstroms with a roughness of less than 1 unit cell. For those of people that know about how to prepare these things, this is a non-trivial kind of a thing. The reason for that is you will see that this phenomena only occurs in thin films. It's not a bulk. In the bulk, for technical reasons, actually, it doesn't occur. In principle, it should, but it doesn't. Then you want to know what the structure of your film is, and it's important to know how homogeneous these films are, because if the films are not very homogeneous, it turns out that the width of the transitions are quite broad, and if you want to cycle and you want to study the phenomena in one material, not in one several materials, then you have to have a transition which is sharp enough so that you can see the effects that I'm going to describe to you. That also refers to this. You want to have uniform oxygen stoichiometry, and I actually think that this is an issue in general in this whole field, and nobody wants to face this, if you forgive me, like a man. Is the fact that these materials are intrinsically inhomogeneous. And I think that this is an issue that when you talk about stripes and you talk about inhomogeneities measured with tunneling and all these kind of things that has been very popular nowadays, you should face the fact that it may be that there is a lot of inhomogeneities which are just intrinsically due to some metallurgical and kind of material science kind of problems that we physicists don't like to hear about, but they are there. And the other thing that we are able to do is we're able to vary in yttrium barium copper oxide the praseodymium concentration and make a whole gradient of praseodymium samples on one wafer made at the same time. Hopefully, if one can do that by something called the phase spread alloy technique, and hopefully you can do that, then one can actually study the phenomena that I will describe to you here. Now let me just give you some background about this. Actually, the background actually involves even Santa Barbara. It was found already in 1989 by Higgins' group here in Santa Barbara. If you take oxygen-deficient YBCO bulk single crystals, you can see a transient photoconductivity on them. You can put light on it very fast. It did it in a very strange way, not by measuring some propagation in some strange structure. But anyhow, they found that there is a transient photoconductivity that you can see in oxygen-deficient.
How transient?
It was very transient. It was like in the picosecond kind of thing. Okay? That's not what I'm going to talk about. But I just wanted to give you the background, okay? It was also found many years ago that if you take indium and you put it in cadmium sulfur, mix it in cadmium sulfur is a photoconducting material, then you see a change that looks like this. You see, here is the resistance versus temperature for this mixture. And you see, if you put the indium in cadmium sulfide that separates these indium grains, then you see a transition which occurs at the 3.4 degrees or 3.5 degrees, which is the indium transition temperature. And then if you, before irradiating it, the curve looks like this. You irradiate it, the width of the transition changes, but the onset doesn't. That's the key. This is what was seen before. And then, based on that, there was two more experiments which are related to this. There was this experiment by Kudinov, which what he found is that the resistance, you see, he takes a sample, resistance YBCO, oxygen deficient, and he irradiates it with light, and the resistance goes from here to there. But you see, it looks kind of similar to the indium cadmium sulfide, except that the resistance now changes. Notice in the indium case, the resistance didn't change, the resistivity. And the question is there a persistent photoinduced superconductivity, not just conductivity change here because of carrier change? Okay, and then there is something which is actually, I believe it's related to this, although not everybody believes that. There was this electric field effects in YBCO films where people could make 5 mK changes by injecting carriers actually into YBCO. Okay. So now I will describe for you how we do these experiments. Yeah?
Say 5 mK?
Yeah. Okay, so they could see two kinds of changes. They could see if they inject holes, they could see a 5 mK increase or 10 mK. I guess at the end there was more, like maybe 10 mK or 15, I don't remember exactly. But then if you reversed it and you injected electrons, then the transition temperature really went down. Now, putting the transition temperature down is not a big deal. I can tell you my son, who actually graduated from Santa Barbara in chemistry, when he was 5 years old, he could make the TC go down. All he had to do is walk by the lab and hit my door with a hammer. That's not a big deal. It's putting the TC going up. That's the trick. Okay. So here it is, the experimental setup. You take a cryostat, you put a sample inside of it, and then what you do is you radiate it with a variety of light sources. You can do this with a... Originally, we started with a very high-power argon laser. Okay, then we eventually slowly converged them to this kind of arrangement. You can take a mercury xenon lamp, and you can have some filters on the way here, and then you can irradiate it, do frequency-dependent measurements, and you can do things in the magnetic field, and you can vary the intensity of this irradiation. Okay? Now the reason that this is interesting, okay, so here it is again, even more schematically. It's the lack of jogging today in the morning. I actually was really sick yesterday. Yet totally, I'm a little bit congested, so please forgive me if I'm a little bit not up to my standards of telling jokes today, but. Okay, so here's the experimental method that I will describe to you. You put a sample here, for instance, in liquid nitrogen. Okay, so there's no oxygen anywhere around this sample, right? So, because that's a big suspicion. Take an argon laser, that's how we did it first. Or you take a halogen lamp and you put the nitrogen gas around it, or you put it in vacuum. You can do it in various ways, and we did it in all these ways. You measure the resistivity and the TC with the light off. Okay, then you shine light on it for long periods of time. When I mean long periods of time, I mean 8 hours or something. Okay, and then you turn the light off again. Okay? And measure the resistance in the light off. That's a simple experiment. Right? And that's where we get our first surprise. Now remember, we want to look at this. This is what we want to look at. So before I show you the data, I just want to show you what we want to look at. We want to look at something, at these materials that either underdoped or overdoped. And remember that if you look at the TC as a function of number of carriers, the thing does something that looks like that. I'm not going to debate all the details of all this. But the resistance just has a monotonic curve. So if I do an experiment here, okay, and something happens, the resistance is going to have the opposite effect than the TC. But if I do an experiment here, they're going to have the same effect. So I will be able to actually tell from this experiment whether the thing is underdoped or overdoped. I actually also believe that perhaps this is the one proof that you have overdoped or underdoped. Remember, decreasing the TC of things, it's easy. Everybody can do that. Even the theorists can do it. Okay. So here it is, the first experiment. So here's the basic effect of this. This was the very first. Well, why the hell am I doing this? The hell with this? Okay, so here it is. So here is the resistance versus temperature for gadolinium. Turns out for technical reasons, we did gadolinium 1, 2, 3. So here it is the resistance before. There is a peak in the transition temperature there. And then you irradiate it, you do the experiment just like I'm describing to you. You irradiate. Long period of time, stop it. This was done with argon laser.
What temperature is the radiation?
The irradiation is done, this was originally was done at 77 degrees, but eventually we converged about doing it above the TC, so above TC at 100 degrees. Okay, so now this experiment actually was done at 77 degrees, the irradiation of this. Remember, these are oxygen deficient samples, so the TC of them is depressed. Okay. And they are.
But I'm wondering if the oxygen could move under the irradiation.
Of course, that's a very good question. And that's, I'm going to address that question. I'm going to get to that point.
It's really interesting to get that shape resistivity from above TC, such a low TC.
Wait, don't worry about that yet, because there is going to be so much data here that if you start worrying about every curve and the details of it,
well,
you're going
to... That would, yeah. That's new to me. I mean,
well, I don't know.
I've seen such a low TC have a slope in the resistivity versus temperature, looks
like.
Okay. It's more important.
Okay. Okay, so notice that what happens is the resistance goes down and the TC goes up, just like I described to you in the underdog regime, okay? Incidentally, if you take a sample that is actually very, very oxygen deficient, like it is an insulator, you can drive it superconducting, like at 35 degrees, we have done that experiment, or you can actually, if it's very, very insulated, you can change the conductivity by as much as 4 orders of magnitude. So this stuff is really very photoconducting. in addition to being to becoming superconducting. It's very, very photoconducting.
What is temperature in this high temperature? Linear here?
Yeah, it is linear.
Those, yeah. Those.
Yeah. Yeah, this is the AB plane conductivity. Okay? Notice that if I do the thallium, if I take the thallium compound, and of course it took us a while to get to this point, as you can see there is a few years passed in between this. That's the same thing. If you look at the thallium compound, the opposite happens. Okay, this is the thallium 2201 compound, okay? And in this case, again, I haven't changed colors on you, so I'm keeping the, I'm trying to keep the color coding the same, okay? You radiate the sample, so without illumination is blue. You radiate the sample, the TC goes down, and the resistance also goes down. Okay, just like it should in an overdoped, material. Okay. Okay. So the main point.
The quantity was much less.
Yeah. Right. But that depends actually on how much you radiate, and it you will see at the end of this talk is that it depends, for instance, on the thickness of the films that you have. That's why this is a thin film kind of an effect. It turns out for reasons which I'll get. So basically, the my point here actually, and in fact my point of my first graph of this graph is the following: is when we used to work, and Doug knows this because Doug wrote this famous paper, the Owen and Scalopino paper, that still nowadays is being referred to. When we used to irradiate superconductors with light in the old times, the TC invariably went down. That's it, and that was not very interesting because that looks like heating. So who the hell cares? I mean, it's really, you know, it's like some complicated heating, but it's heating anyhow. Here, it's opposite. This thing goes up, and can go up substantially.
Are these irradiated, and then you stop irradiating?
Right, right. That's, yeah.
How long does it
last? It lasts, if you keep it at 100 degrees, it lasts forever.
Okay.
But if you take it to room, I'll show you that in a second. Okay? Okay, so the main point is this, that illumination has unexpected effects in oxygen-deficient high-TC superconductors, and if you're sick and you cannot convey this idea, is that you have to get excited about this thing. Okay, that's the transparency is when I get sick. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to describe for you the various sort of... So one day I was giving this talk to, I mean, not this talk exactly, but some similar talk to this, and one of my friends asked me, what the hell are you doing all these experiments? So I started scratching my head and wondering, yeah, why am I doing these experiments? I mean, besides the fact that I did my thesis on this and, you know, I kind of got enamored on this kind of stuff. And so here it is, why do I do this experiment? It is very, very unlike low TC. And maybe there is a clue in this somehow. I don't know. Maybe there isn't, but maybe there's a clue to something on this. It's very unexpected. It was very unexpected when we did it. In fact, I thought that this will never happen. And therefore, it's interesting. Actually, you can make devices with this, believe it or not. And it's a controllable way of changing doping. So if you're interested in making an experiment where you want to very fine-tune the doping and do it in a continuous fashion, go back and forth and back and forth, this is the way to do it, not changing materials. Okay? So that's why this is interesting. So that's why I was doing these experiments. I discovered later after I did a lot of them. Okay? Okay, so let me get back to your questions, which is the question is what? How long does this thing last? Okay, so here it is what happens. Suppose you measure the resistance during excitation at room temperature now. Okay? So at room temperature, you start irradiating, and this is the resistance, and this thing gets, the resistance decreases, okay? Goes down, now you stop at that point at room temperature and let it relax. If you stop at 100 degrees, nothing happens. But if you stop at room temperature, you let it relax. It relaxes like this. Okay, and it relaxes, you know, after many years of doing this thing, it relaxes as a stretch exponential. Okay, and if you attach some kind of an energy to this stretch exponential, you get an energy of about 0.9 electron volts. Now, 0.9 electron volts, for those of you guys who are not experimentalists, perhaps, it reminds us of something, which is it turns out that the binding energy of an oxygen atom in the chains of YBCO is about of the order of 1 electron volt. And this will come back when we will ask what causes all this stuff. Okay? So I think that 0.9 electron volt has maybe some meaning.
What's beta?
Huh?
What's beta?
good question, Steve. I don't remember. I have no idea. I don't remember. I mean, to be perfectly honest, we did all these experiments, and then somebody else started doing time-dependent experiment, and I don't like to compete. I like to start my own bandwagon, so I don't like to compete, so I left them doing the time dependence. And it's fitting curves, and I hate fitting curves, actually. So there's those two things that really got me.
But Kudinov has this in his paper. He knows.
Yeah, who is this?
Kudinov.
Yeah, Kudinov. He did some of that. So you want to ask the same question in the bismuth compound. See, for instance, there it is, the bismuth compound. That's the same thing. Okay? You radiate it, the resistance, the effect is much smaller now. But you radiate it, the resistance goes down. You stop, you let it relax, the resistance goes up again. Okay?
This is at 90 Kelvin.
Yeah, this is at 90 Kelvin.
So here it doesn't stay.
No, he doesn't stay at 90 Kelvin, but if you go down to this is actually, it's again, you know, it's doped, so it is, the TC is very low, so if you go down to low temperature, it stays forever. So this is what is called, the persistent but not permanent effect. Okay? Okay, now here it is, the first question that you want to ask. Is the effect due to oxygen absorption? And that's, I'm very concerned about these sort of things myself, so I can tell you this unequivocally, the effect is not due to oxygen absorption. We've done the experiments in various different configurations, and oxygen doesn't move in and out of the sample. And the fact that it relaxes back to where it came from indicates that it is not due to oxygen absorption. It could be some oxygen rearranging within the sample, but the fact that the TC goes up in YBCO, it means that the oxygen has to be ordering. And then when it relaxes, it has to be disordering, just contrary to what you would think that what will happen. So somehow, not only that, I actually don't believe that it is due to ordering. So there is no oxygen absorption from the substrate or the environment because this thing is reversible. It could be from the substrate instead.
Why does the reversibility mean it can't be actually absorption? Because we know it's reversibly.
Well, because you immerse it in liquid nitrogen. Mm-hmm. Now, where is the oxygen going to come from?
Well, you just said, what about from the substrate up there?
Well, so you put it on different kind of substrate, and it's always the effect is the same.
Presumably you know a lot about the oxygen mobility and how it...
Well, yeah, but I want to argue this. Yeah, sure.
And you're working in a completely different...
Right, right. But that's sort of a theoretical argument. I don't like make that. I like to make more experimental arguments. So I agree with you, sir.
We experimental
with
together.
I'm only saying we know the data, right?
But use lanthanum illuminate and...
We have used the, actually practically in every substrate known to man, we have done, and the effect is always the same. And in fact, the guy who refereed my first paper was Alan Goldman. And Alan Goldman told me actually that he didn't believe a word of it when he refereed the first paper, so he went and repeated the experiment. And it was there. It's actually an
did you do any x-rays to see...
Stand up. That's coming. Okay, so here it is what happens with doping. So if you change the doping, you see... If you change the doping from 6.6 or 6.55 to 6.5, the effect becomes bigger. So the effect becomes bigger as you're coming closer and closer to the metal insulator transition with oxygen defects, okay? That will turn out to be significant. All right? Okay, so here it is. So, I mean, I think there is so many facts here that I'm going to start keeping track of the facts for you so that you don't forget them, okay? So the first thing that it increases the TC in YBCO, decreases the resistance. The transition will remain unchanged, okay? So it's not one of these indium cadmium sulfide business. And the effects are enhanced near the metal insulator transition. Okay, so now let me look at what causes this effect. I'll answer your question, Laura. If I don't, just come back to me. So here it is what happens the first thing that you want to ask is the number of carriers changing, of course. Okay, and so here there is a measurement of the resistance, the Hall effect, and the mobility actually extracted from the resistance and the Hall effect on the same sample at the same time. Okay? And you can see that the resistance, again, this is during illumination, this is after illumination, so the resistance goes as 1 over the mobility times N times the charge of whatever. I have to say Hall field because Jorge Hirsch will kill me if I don't. And you see the Hall effect also does the same kind of a thing. And notice that if you interpret the Hall effect, and I'm not sure that you can do that, but if you want to interpret the Hall effect as 1/2 density of carriers, then this does exactly that. It implies that the number of carriers is increasing in this thing with light irradiation. Okay? And the mobility does something strange, actually, which we don't understand. So I'm going to start showing you things that I don't understand, and I'm not sure I will ever understand. But the mobility doesn't quite track this thing. It does something strange, which is I'm not sure what it means.
Is it correct that the Hall effect does not recover, the Hall constant does not recover?
Well, it seems that was actually a worrisome thing. Yeah, it seems like it's not completely recovered. I don't know what to say to that. Okay. But this is not true, actually, in all the samples. This is in this particular sample, it was true. So it may be that something happens to the sample when you write it.
What, in the very first?
That was the resistance.
The resistivity, it didn't recover.
Sorry? The resistance doesn't recover.
The very first one.
It does recover.
Don't go back.
The resistance does recover. The Hall effect, this particular Hall effect data that you're showing, you're absolutely, I must confess, you have a very keen eye. It does not fully recover, and I worried about it, but that's all I did. I'm not going to. Okay, so here it is. So there is an increase in the number of carriers, but the reason I say that is not the whole story is because the mobility doesn't quite do what it is supposed to be doing, okay? It doesn't follow the whole thing, so I'm not sure what if there is any meaning to that, what happens to the mobility. Okay, so now I'm going to come to you, to your question about the structure. What happens to the structure? Okay, so here it is what you do with the structure. Now remember, these are thin films, so there is you can do neutrons on these and refine the neutron. So I do X-rays and I refine the X-rays. And if you look, here it is before illumination, and here it is after illumination. And you look at those two curves and say, well, those two things look the same, right? Well, in fact, they don't. Now, you have to be a little bit tricky. What you have to do is you have to actually measure both things at the same time on the same, and do the whole experiment in your X-ray refractometer, and then you discover that actually they are not doing the same thing. The structure does change slightly. There's a slight shift, okay, of the X-ray diffraction. And remember, the way we do this experiment, we irradiate and we stop irradiating, so it is thermal expansion will give you something like this, perhaps, a shift.
Does it go in that? I can't tell which direction
it's going. Okay, I'll show you in which direction in a second, but that's a very good question, all right? So suffice it to say that there is a slight shift, which means that the lattice parameters do change a little bit, okay? And very delicately they change quite a little bit, so I'm going to show you how delicately they change. Here it is. This is what it does. This is the answer to your question, Laura. The C-axis actually contracts upon illumination. It doesn't expand. So thermal expansion, so it doesn't matter. I worried a lot about whether this thing is heating up and the heat stays there forever somehow. In fact, it doesn't because this thing is contracting. So it's thermal heating cannot explain these results. And in fact, here it is, this data. Okay, so here it is a comparison of the resistance, that is the resistivity, that are over rho, which is, I guess, the green curve, and then this data subtracting these two X-ray things, okay? Plotted on the same axis so that you can compare to them. So here it is the lattice parameter, delta C over C, okay? And notice that these two things track each other. But notice here the axis. This is a really small expansion, tiny little expansion.
How does TC track with delta over
rho? TC and delta over rho track very well, okay?
But this one
you can measure it simultaneously. You see, you can do the same measurement in the same sample. I'm always concerned about making from one sample and comparing with another sample. This is measured in the very same sample, the very same setup at the same time. So there is no question I'm comparing apples and apples here. Okay? And it tracks quite well. There is a slight problem. And I think we understand that. Some of this data actually is unpublished for a variety of reasons. My postdoc, actually, that was one of my students that did his thesis on this, got a job at the labs, and then he decided to go and make money, and now he owns some kind of a software company. So I hope he donates $100 million, I saw this Canadian guy that donated $100 million. Okay. So here it is, delta rho over rho, plotted as a function of delta C over C. Okay, so I'm plotting the expansion and the change in resistivity on top of each other. And this is during the irradiation, and this is after irradiation. And this is pretty weird, okay, because the thing doesn't excite itself the same way exactly as it de-excites. But actually, this is a kind of a trivial thing that you can explain by the fact that the light only penetrates into this material up to a certain depth. And then as you're exciting the thing, you're exciting the thing up to a certain depth, and the thing kind of propagates into the material slowly, okay? So it takes a while for the whole sample to be excited. Once the whole sample is excited, it decays together, okay? And in fact, if you measure, you see, I thought that there was something very significant about this for a while. So we measured this as a function of thickness of films. If you do this measurement as a function of the thickness of the film, you find that the hysteresis goes away at around 400 angstrom of thickness. So the effect penetrates only in the surface of about 400 angstroms on the screen, all right? And that's why if you want to do a bulk experiment, it'll take you forever to measure this problem.
You know, the main part of the whole conductivity recovery,
the what?
The part where whole resistivity.
Oh, I don't know. I have no idea. I don't know. Well, it's maybe in the thesis somewhere, but you know, I guess I never answered that question. Okay, so here it is. Now, the structural changes are analogous to oxygen absorption. Okay, it turns out that there's this weird thing that actually is kind of unexpected, I mean, if you think about it naively, that you take oxygen out and that you put oxygen in and the thing contracts. Kind of strange. Okay? Because you expect if you put something into the bag, your bag it grows, and it doesn't. This bag decreases. And this thing does the same. You put you dope it with holes, and the C-axis contracts. Okay. Actually, if you look at the comparison, here it is the same curve that I took from some Japanese work, Okubo. And actually, I replotted it in this way, like I've been showing it to you. Delta rho over rho as a function of delta C over C. And this actually fits quite well into this curve. So it does look like oxygen, like changes in oxygen, but it is not. So it is obviously it has to do just with the doping of the carriers. And
the rearrangements in oxygen will do the same thing.
Yeah, there is a debate about this. I can tell you that even within my own group, we cannot agree on what actually the phenomenon is. So I'll get to that in a second. But anyhow, the structural changes are analogous to increasing the oxygen concentration. So that's the next thing. Okay, so now the next question that you want to ask, what about this metal-insulator transition? Is this the proximity to the metal-insulator transition is the significant thing as opposed to the oxygen deficiency? Okay? Remember, you all guys know this, but the question is that the effect of light with the oxygen, it's similar to oxygen concentration, okay? The question is, suppose I take a praseodymium-doped yttrium barium copper oxide. Now you can see where all these technical developments start coming handy here. Because I can make, and it's important to make sure that the oxygen is always the same. So what I do is I make a phase spread alloy where I have a bunch of praseodymium-doped YBCO samples on the same wafer that are prepared all at the same time. They are doped all at the same time. Presumably, they have the same oxygen concentration. Notice I say the word presumably because I'm not 100% sure of that. It's very difficult to determine to very high accuracy there. And the question is, does light, again, do the same kind of a thing with this? Okay? So here it is the experiment on that. Okay, so these are the samples. You see, this is actually an interesting thing because this can be applied to many other things. This is what I was telling you, Doug, about this phase spread alloy method. So here is five samples on the same wafer, praseodymium doped YBCO or gadolinium BCO. Okay, and notice that on the same wafer, depending on the position along the wafer, I get all the different samples. Okay, so I'm kind of more or less assuring that I know what I'm doing here, okay? And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take all these samples at the same time, measure them at the same time, evaluate them at the same time, and ask the question, what happens then? And there's the result. Nothing happens, okay? So that's again, the experiment before and after, like I showed you before, and you see nothing happens. So the proximity per se, if you just get yourself close, if the thing is fully oxygenated, all seven, that's what this is, somewhere. 07 right there. Okay, and if this is fully oxygenated, nothing happens. So oxygen deficiency is somehow crucial for this whole business. Okay? However, there is an ununderstood thing. If you take actually an oxygen 6.7, I'm not sure that this will ever be understood. I think this is somehow significant. So here is the oxygen 6.7, same kind of samples. And you can see now it's the experimentalist hard time. Before I had five samples, now suddenly one of the samples died on me. I don't know why. disconnected or scratched or God knows what. And now if you radiate this sample, then the effect is different. Okay? It depends how close, if you push yourself closer and closer to the metal insulator transition with praseodymium, the effect becomes bigger and bigger. Okay? Remember, here's the oxygen stoichiometry is kept fixed, but I'm changing the praseodymium concentration as I'm going down there. And as I'm coming closer and closer to the metal insulator transition, the same amount of oxygen deficiency, the effect becomes bigger. And actually, I think that...
Tell you something like the oxygen vacancy is capable of, I'm not sure, trapping an electron, and so when you radiate it, you might trap it, and then leave holes in the plane for a while.
It's possible that is something like that, that somehow the praseodymium, that actually the interpretation... I mean, if you take the old interpretation of how praseodymium, why the praseodymium compounds are not superconducting, then you cannot explain this data. Now you have to explain something like you're saying, you have to use something like you're saying, invoke something like you're saying, that that the praseodymium acts perhaps as a trap for electrons or something. Yeah?
The scales are different over here, so...
The scales are different.
Is the effect really bigger?
What do you mean the scales are different?
Well, the scale on the bottom is four times bigger than the scale on the top, and the change in resistivity looks like it's about factor four also.
Okay, well, look at the resistance change. Okay, so look here at this change here. Okay, fine, I understand what you're saying, but I'm saying to you, look at what I'm trying to argue is that the TC change here is zero, and the TC change is something finite. Okay?
Well, the resistivity change is comparable.
Yeah, the resistivity change maybe is comparable. Maybe. Yeah, could be. Well, okay, and I don't know, we didn't make much out of this. Okay, anyway, so the point is that there is no changes in the full oxygen. That's certainly true. There is no changes in the full oxygen in the praseodymium sample. So therefore, the oxygen deficiency is crucial. That certainly is a tight shut conclusion. The other one, you know, maybe we have to look more in detail. Okay, so then what I want to do is now I want to look at the frequency dependence of all this. Okay, see how the effect is changes with frequency dependence. And here's the change with frequency dependence, okay? So this is a frequency dependence, and I was told that there are some, now this is plotted in a strange way, because what we do is plot is 1 over n, 1 over the change in the number of carriers or in the conductivity, and you see the frequency change answer is quite enhanced. Most of the experiments originally were done around here, but actually the effect is quite enhanced at 4.1 electron volts in YVCO. Okay? And the claim that there is some kind of an excitation in the copper oxygen chain that you can do at 4 electron volts, that somehow that may be significant. Okay? So, now if you go to the kalium compound on the other hand, the thing is totally different, and these I really totally fail to understand. There is all kind of people that came and told me things, and so I wrote these things down for you, but I'm not sure how significant it is, because there is claim that there is in the thallium, there are two type of defects in the thallium oxide layer which correlate with these plateaus here in the photon energy, the magnitude of the effect in the photon energy. Okay. Now I'm not sure of this, but there is claim that it is correlated with these two different excited states. But in anyhow, suffice it to say that the frequency dependence is different from different systems. Okay, so in the yttrium, in the YBCO, if you do it in YBCO, you do it in gadolinium BCO, you do it in various type of 1, 2, 3 compounds, they all have a very big peak at 4.4 electron volts. In the thallium compound, we actually didn't do it in that many. We did it only on this compound, and that's what we see.
So that's the inverse
function. Yeah. Well, no, in this case, it's the delta rho, or the maximum change in rho, which is 1 over n, okay, divided by rho. Okay, so let me just get first to the possible explanations of this. Okay? Okay, so there is various possible explanations for this effect. The first possible explanation that comes to your mind is this Josephson coupling thing, that you have somehow granular superconductivity, and somehow by light you kind of increase the conductivity across this between grain to grain, and then you know things happen. That's probably unlikely since there is no intrinsic inhomogeneities. Now there may be some inhomogeneities there in the sample, okay? But since you can take a completely non-superconducting sample make it superconducting, it's probably unlikely. And there's two other explanations which are possible. One of them that Laura brought up, which is the Kudde local oxygen ordering. There's a variety of reasons why this is probably not the fact, but it explains the long relaxation times. And it explains the structural changes, okay? And actually, there is a recent measurement by somebody actually that was in my group 10 years ago, and he went on his own, and he just stabbed me in the back because he went and published this paper, and she claimed that it is oxygen ordering. When he was in my lab, he claimed that it was not oxygen ordering, okay? So that's okay. Well, yeah, it's been 10 years, so he doesn't owe me any loyalty, I guess. And it is consistent with Raman scattering. Now, what this is all based on is on looking at a particular peak of the Raman scattering, identifying that Raman peak with the length of the chain, and then measuring and seeing that Raman peak increase in intensity. Yeah?
But the Raman goes thousands of angstroms into the sample, and you're claiming this is a 400 angstrom deep effect. So the Raman could be sampling a completely different part of the sample. It may not be relevant at all.
Yeah, it may not be relevant. It may even be, I think that it's not relevant in a different way, actually. I don't think it's relevant in the fact that the identification of that particular Raman line as the length of the chain is the irrelevant. That's what I think is the irrelevant.
There's indication now that that is being misidentified.
Okay, really?
Good
word, example. Really? Okay, so that's this guy, actually, Feinstein.
You won.
Huh?
Did you actually say that this is a 400 angstrom effect?
Yeah, I said that this hysteresis, remember there was a hysteresis, that if you plotted the change in resistance as a function of the change in the lattice parameter, the thing went to a hysteresis. When you excited it, it went up, and then when you de-excited it, it went straight down, okay? And what I said to you is that that hysteresis, the width of that hysteresis, changes with the thickness of the film. And the reason for that is how we interpret it. It is that when you excite, you only excite part of the sample, okay?
How far?
Well, 400 angstrom, because at 400 angstrom, the effect goes away.
But you know the optical constants of the material.
Yeah, I think that's consistent. It's kind of consistent. Because this metallic, those measurements that were done were in the metallic phase, and so it is consistent.
Probably something like a, what do you call it? You know, there's a follow-up of the length that goes in the sample.
Right, it's exponential, of course.
Well, this is what I was thinking of.
Yeah.
Doing this as a function of intensity of the light.
Well,
and also wavelength of the light.
Yeah. I mean, you could do all these experiments, of course, but also when a hatchet comes down on your funding, you kind of give up.
No, but you haven't seen any arguments why it's not, even the hysteresis
which is what?
Oxygen ordering. I still don't see any reason why it's not oxygen ordering.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so wait, so why is it not oxygen? Okay, I can tell you why not, because there is a in DX center, for instance, in gallium arsenide, there is a very simple explanation. I was giving this talk when these people in Xerox heard about this, so they thought photoconductivity, they didn't like that stuff. So I went to Xerox to give a talk, and one guy came to me and said to me, you know, there's a very similar effect, DX centers in gallium arsenide, and there is some other kind of centers in silicon. And then the explanation is a very simple explanation. They say the explanation is that you have some vacancies, like in this case, or the oxygen vacancies, and they act as a deep trap, okay? Remember I told you at the beginning of this talk that there was a 0.9 electron volt something or another, okay? So the 0.9 electron volts now becomes very significant because I actually myself measure the energy, the trapping of this energy of the oxygen. So if the electron falls into the trap, it's 0.9 electron volts. And it explains most of the observed phenomena. It's very similar to DX centers in gallium arsenide. So it's nothing unusual, you know? It's not like I have come up with some...
What do you say most? Is there something that you think it doesn't explain?
Well, no, there are all these questions, for instance, like Elihu was asking about, you know, this presidium thing. I'm not sure that it explains it or it doesn't, or that's relevant or not. So I don't have any evidence. Let me put it, I put most to be on the safe side. I don't have anything that it doesn't. No. Yeah?
Do the photo-induced charge transfer experiments that you want to make as an explanation, do they show a change in the lattice constants? Like you see in your...
Everything is always tied. It is like the hip bone that is tied to the knee bone, you know. Everything is tied together because they say...
A definite change in lattice constant. Do they see it in the semiconductor experiment?
Oh.
No, it's incredibly small concentration.
It's very, yeah.
I mean, all the experiments in quantum Hall effect are done in systems where they photo-excited it first.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What, you want to make that your explanation then?
I kind of favor this explanation. I favor that the explanation is probably something like this. That what you do is you have a charge reservoir in a superconducting plane. Then you excite an electron hole pair. The holes go into the superconducting plane, the electron gets trapped somewhere in the oxygen vacancy, and then there's a bunch of holes there, and these holes condense. That's it. That's basically my experiment. I mean, that's very straightforward. There is nothing mysterious about that. I don't have to invoke any strange things. Okay? And the numbers are kind of agree. I mean, the 0.9 electron volts agrees with the energy of the so everything kind of falls in place for me. So that's why I kind of favor this explanation. I'm not really sure it is, but I kind of favor it. Okay? And the periodic electron, this band split into two. At one moment, even in my lab, people are fighting about this.
Excuse me, do you need for this explanation that the carboxylation chains are actually not superconducting then? You're basically saying the carboxylation planes become superconducting, but the carboxylation chains remain normal?
No, I don't think it makes any difference to that.
So it doesn't really matter whether the carboxylation chains...
No, all the chains are doing for you, the vacancies in the chains are doing for you, is trapping this electron, and that's what gives rise to the long relaxation time.
Okay. We're discussing over here, and
yes.
How does that make the lattice constant change?
The lattice constant changes.
Well, how does that make that happen?
Well, I mean, there is a look. If you put electrons into some system, the lattice constants can change. That is not very unusual. I mean, basically, you're balancing charges, okay? If you like. Okay, so it's like so you're putting more charge in there, you balance out the charge, and the thing can contract more inwards. That's how it changes that. That's not unusual.
No, I know, but those are set changes that you see, like when you change oxygen contact or you reorder the oxygen. So those kind of changes...
No. Wait, hold on.
Those kind of changes you can see by oxygen reordering.
No. Those curves that I showed were with oxygen doping, right. Not with oxygen ordering.
But you get the same kind of curves with oxygen ordering.
Yeah, but that could be that the oxygen orders, more charge goes in the flame, the
yes.
Charge does...
Right. I mean, that's the problem. To distinguish these two things is not so easy. Actually, okay. So,
question.
Yeah.
If you have material with no chains.
Yeah. Okay. So we saw it in the thallium compounds. We saw it in the bismuth compounds. The only one that we didn't see it, and I actually got some samples from Jean-Pierre Loquet from IBM in Zurich, actually, who presumably makes the best lanthanum strontium thin film. Okay, and he can do. This is this guy that made this lanthanum strontium that is expanded and it has a very very high TC. Actually, was a student of mine at one stage. But anyway, that guy gave me some sample of lanthanum strontium, which were fantastic, and we didn't see anything. So I don't know why we didn't see.
It's only YBCO.
No, YBCO, thallium, and the bismuth compounds, and now in the manganites.
So the only compound where it works.
Where it doesn't work is the lanthanum strontium. Where it does not work, it's lanthanum strontium. But we didn't spend that much time in trying to look for it. Because as I said, there was many, you know, everybody was asking me, how about this, how about that? So I kind of was going schizophrenical in all directions trying to do something.
So say if you look at the compound with no chains, like bisca,
yeah.
What would be trapping the chain?
Well, there may be some defect somewhere in there. I mean, I don't know, you know, there may be some defect somewhere in the sample somewhere.
But do you have some typical also trapping energy, like 0.9?
No, that one I know. Because see, the reason that I know about the trapping, I did a lot of experiments in the early states of this whole field where I used to dissolve oxygen from the sample and reabsorb it, and by that I could get the energy of trapping of the oxygen. So I did a lot of, so that was very close to my heart, of course. You know, I knew those numbers, I've done those experiments, so I knew those numbers, but I never did that kind of experiments in BISCO, no. So I don't know any.
Is it true, though, the effect's biggest in under-built YBCO?
Yes,
where you have
definitely.
You have a real
definitely.
Trap.
Yes, no question about that. The biggest is in YBCO. Okay. Okay, so now at this moment it's 1 o'clock, so here it is. Okay, so here is the answer to your question, actually. It's right there, okay. Okay, it's right there. See, I don't know what is in lanthanum strontium. I don't know why it's not there. And actually, at some moment, we did the experiment and we thought we saw something, and then, you know, it kind of is one of those things. Okay, now, I want to emphasize the one more thing that Doug is always worried about is has this been repeated by other people? And I can tell you, this has been repeated ad infinitum by lots of different people in different laboratories. So this is not some strange things. And since I'm exactly on my time, right? Now, so that's so because I have a lot of other effects, but so I'll just put up a list for you guys. Okay, and if you're interested, I can tell you more about it, but I'm not going to show you things. And here it is, there was work done by other people. Okay? So there was the Raman scattering, actually measurements which are in agreement with us, done by Günterhoff in Aachen and Grimsdijk in Argonne. There was the frequency dependence done by Kudinov and some guy Butko in Paul Chu's group. They spent a lot of time on time dependencies of this. There's actually some luminescence experiments also done, as you may imagine luminescence will be crucial here, because if you trap this electron into some kind of a vacancy, you can measure the luminescence that comes out, and that is another way of getting, we get the energy from the time dependence, from the stretched exponentials, they can get the energy directly from the luminescence. They're all in agreement. Similar effects actually have been claimed in carbon 60, believe it or not. And there were some experiments on iron-silicon multilayer from Altin, some magnetic effects, which are very similar to this. I think those experiments actually are wrong, but never mind that. And then there was this guy, Miyano, in Tokyo, who looked at lanthanum manganites doped with praseodymium, and he also saw similar effects. Okay, so he's there in the manganites also. And so all I want to... Now, I can show you, we did a lot of Josephson effect. We have an extensive review, actually, just published this year, which is, this is a small review. So if you guys really want to know about it, there is an extensive review in the Journal of Superconductivity. Okay, I can send you a copy if you're interested also. And we did a lot of work of this kind of thing in Josephson junctions, but I won't tell you about it. So if you're interested, I can show it to you, but if not, I'll just stop at this one. So we did a lot of experiments where we actually looked at Josephson junctions and actually got some really nice experiments with Josephson junctions but you know, these kind of grain boundary junctions. But
so what did you study there?
Well, here you can irradiate, see what you can do is you can basically tune the Josephson effect by irradiating with light. So this is one of those things, you know, this was sort of the holy grail at some time ago. You wanted
so it's
to
just
do.
A thin little structure.
Right, so the thin little, so you have a fully oxygenated here, fully oxygenated there, and deoxygenated in the middle. So the natural thing is, can you somehow do something with that, and you can actually do things with it.
So does it look like you start to overdouble, like the calcium
dope
grain boundaries?
No. No, but, I mean, I don't want to, I can show you the data, no problem, but I just don't want to, you know, it's on time, and I like to finish on time.
Well, you can have another 5 minutes.
Okay, so here it is, for instance, the grain boundary junctions, okay? At 12K. You see the Josephson effect, okay? And then you see that after irradiation the Josephson effect increases. Okay? Now since you believe this, I could probably sell you a bridge, because this doesn't prove there is Josephson effect there. It only proves that there is a short across the sample, right? Okay, but anyways, I'll just leave you with that for a moment. Okay, good question. Okay, but the first thing that I want to do is just compare that with the curve that will be measured in the thin films, and I can see I can do something that nobody else can do. I can actually measure the oxygen concentration in the grain boundary. And I can put a number to it, 6.6 plus minus 0.1. Okay? Because I compare the resistance with the change in resistance with the oxygen content that scales. You see? You understand? Okay, so I can do something that nobody else can do, but here it is, the question that you are asking. There it is. So there's the Fraunhofer. So there is a Fraunhofer pattern. So this is Josephson effect. And it's interesting because the intensity increases, but the position doesn't. Okay, that's significant because that means immediately that lambda doesn't change. Okay? But if you look at the Fisk resonances, which we also looked at, okay, so it's quite a bit of where I hit. This is why I don't want to. Actually, the Fisk resonances do change enormously. So for those of you guys that know about Fisk resonances, and look how much it changes. They both the intensity of the Fisk resonance changes by factors of 2, and it shifts enormously. And actually, you can correlate that with the change in the barrier, in the dielectric constant of the barrier. Okay, so that was also again consistent with this business that the nature of the oxygen efficiency changes. Okay, well, so I have a lot of results like this, but I really don't want to keep on boring you. So here it is. I'll just put up these conclusions and leave it there. Okay.
So the grain boundary comes out naturally as oxygen deficient.
No, actually, what you do is these are two grain. You make a subset that which is made out of two grains. You kind of do this to them. Okay, and then you grow on top of that substrate, and then you do a lithography on it. Okay, so it's a grain boundary in the substrate, which forms a grain boundary in the film because of growth, and then you form a grain boundary right there. Presumably, I mean, there is a lot of debates of how this actually, why does this work? Because if you look with the electron microscopy, actually, on these grain boundaries, they look like crap. I mean, they look like ragged and this, that. But everybody always draws a line, and the line is supposed to be one angstrom stick or something. Okay, now I don't know, I don't understand why this thing works, but it works. You can see Fraunhofer diffraction is not only a short, and all you do is you take two substrates, you misaligned them, and you glued them together back, and then presumably you have a grain boundary there, and then you do some lithography, which is the lithography is at a much larger scale than any coherent central penetration or anything here, so the micron scale. So the lithography doesn't do anything to this.
Can you explain what you mean by lambda is unchanged in the Fraunhofer pattern? How do you expect the Fraunhofer pattern?
Well, it's true that the spacing should change. Right?
Is that true for a thin film when you have... How is the field oriented in this?
The field is perpendicular, yeah.
So it's penetrating completely everything, right?
Yes, but presumably the quantization is in the area of the junction, right? Isn't that true? And within one penetration depth away from... I know that you guys have been worried.
I think what John's asking you has to do with maybe what we talked about yesterday.
Yeah, exactly.
What happens when this film has a very large penetration gap compared with its size?
Right, so I'm thinking... Okay, so these thoughts are all based on the old thinking.
How big are the films?
The films are 1,000 angstroms, typically.
So they're not much smaller than the penetration depth. So there will be a effective penetration depth.
Yeah, and I think maybe the difference is Ivan's are have a heavy charge density, and the ones we were talking about were made by writing the light. And they not only thinner, but they have very low width. They have very low charge density.
Yeah, for those of you that guys that don't know what they are talking about, it actually, you can use this effect, and one of my ex-collaborators, what they managed to do is to use one of these proxima, what is called scanning near field optical microscopes to write things on a subset. So you can write a superconductor on an insulator, basically write any circuit presumably that you want, okay, using this effect. So let me put it this way. This is not this statement, okay? All that it says is that actually, all I'm saying is that, so if you like, forget about any theoretical statement. This is a theoretical statement. All I'm saying is that the periodicity of the Fraunhofer diffraction pattern doesn't change at all.
Yeah, okay.
That's all I'm saying.
My interpretation of it is that that's just defined by the geometry and not, it doesn't have any... dependence on it.
No, I mean, in the old times, you used to think...
I know, that's why a very thick junction, which is...
Right.
Where the material is many penetration depths thick, and then you can measure that. But in your geometry, I would have thought the field penetrates completely.
Yeah, I mean, I'm willing to,
effects, if nothing else.
But there's still an effective penetration depth, which is lambda squared over the film thickness.
Yeah, that's probably good.
Maybe a few times.
So when you phonotopes, your junction is only 400 angstroms thick?
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
No, in the phototoping, we've done it with all kind of thicknesses, but the one that does, is not hysteretic is 400 angstroms thick. So the phototoping penetrates 400 angstroms. That's
right.
Okay? So I'm not sure. I mean, this statement that I'm telling you is based on the fact that you take an area and you add a lambda into it and
multiply. What do you get for lambda out of that analysis?
I think it is close to what the value. I mean, to be perfectly honest with you, I don't 100% remember it, but I think it's of the order of 2,000 angstrom or something like that. Okay, but I don't 100%. I wouldn't swear to God on that number.
Sure, but yes, if it's only 400 angstrom, then essentially carrier density is non-uniform within lambda.
No. The superconductor is not...
The superconductor is big.
It's 0.7 on both sides.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's the idea. Well, again, you don't know what it is. I mean, what you do is you make this grain boundary, you glue this thing together, you grow this thing, and then you wonder what the hell happened there, how can you get the Josephson effect? And so there is a lot of debates in the Josephson area, why is there a Josephson effect in these things? And so I would claim that based on the photoconductivity, by comparing the numbers, I can give you not only that is oxygen efficient, I can tell you how oxygen efficient it is.
Was every grain boundary that you looked at oxygen efficient? People say that's really general for the field, and I think it's important for something I'm interested in.
Yes,
if you've looked in this, would you say that grain boundaries are always oxygen efficient?
No, I wouldn't say anything about that. I really don't know, Laura. I mean, we made a few junctions.
And all of yours are oxygen.
But all of us, three of them. It's one is true, two is true, therefore it's infinite, like a good physicist, I would say that.
That's in your lab.
I know, in your lab you do everything 1,000 times.
Under strain?
It has to be that somehow the... Because, this forms naturally, a grain boundary, the naturally an oxygen-deficient region there, it seems like.
been stated that we all know now know that all grain binders are oxygen deficient, and I just
well, look,
heard that, and
I actually have, you know, I have a politically incorrect slide here.
Okay.
If you guys don't mind.
How long are you here for?
No, if you guys don't mind me putting up a political incorrect slide, I wasn't sure whether I will do this or I will not do this, and actually I showed it to my colleagues at UCSD, and they very much encouraged me because to put this up, and of course they want me to kill myself in public, but okay. But I'll put it up because I think that this field, and I'll make this generalized statement, I think that this field has a lot of diseases in it which should be corrected. And here it is, okay, so here it is, my political incorrect slide. Okay? And this is the philosophy slide, okay? And I would like to make, I think that many of these, for instance, I know everybody here believes this D-wave to death, right? But I sometimes, you know, I kind of, I like to ask this question, right? Is D-wave, how well it is? Is two-dimensionality, for instance, needed, okay? See, I put that in the tungsten oxide for, okay? And the ruthenium, so you know, I don't know if you guys know about these compounds, but there are these compounds that are claimed that they are both ferromagnetic and superconducting at 58 degrees. Have you guys heard about this? There it is, huh? There are strange compounds, okay? This is the tungsten oxide that Doug was talking to.
Only exists in Hungary or something like that.
Yeah, somewhere, yeah, I forgot where
it
is.
No, it exists in other places.
This one is 90. Yeah, that's what Doug was talking about in the morning. Okay, so these are some of my politically incorrect questions that I think that this has to be addressed, and I think that at some moment when sanity will prevail in this field, we'll go back to those questions. So for instance, to judge the correct theory, how about looking for some predictions that one can change? It would be really nice. But
I mean, you're getting soft. I mean,
yeah, I know.
Politically incorrect, and you have question marks at the end.
Right. Well, it's like,
I mean, there should be declarative statements if you want to be really political.
No, because I was trying to be, I mean, you know, I'll get fired from the university.
You're
but
waffling.
Wait,
you're waffling.
Wait, I'm waffling, but I'm not. But I have two more questions. Wait, I have two more questions that are even more relevant than these ones. Here are the two questions. Why are the stocks of the superconducting companies going to hell? Have you guys wondered about that? And Doug can vouch for this because Doug, you guys look up in Yahoo how some people did with superconductivity financially. And I put this up, but I guess Doug is not going to give me a dollar, okay?
This is worse than a dollar. It's signed.
Yeah, it has to be signed and testified. It has to be testified by Doug. Okay? So I guess that
but
you're not
today because
I guess
that,
today because it's your fault that again. And Elihu wants part of this damn thing. Actually, Elihu
will take it to the Supreme Court.
Elihu, you can vote on it, all of us here. Elihu, let me tell you something. Don't take a part. Just trade with him on part of his stocks that in the money he made on conductors. no conductors. What is it?
He could have made even more money.
No, I don't think so. That was impossible. Anyways, you can tell them later on about the graph that I made.
Look, I only want 50 cents. I don't need it to have to be signed.
Okay. Any other question?
Okay.